University Network from Los Angeles, California, United States of America, presents Dr. Gene Scott.
Modern weaponry. I can't give you a damage report until we smoke it and photograph the remains. The media is a bunch of crap heads. And I would like to believe that you will not stop pouring it on them, making your telephone calls, writing, and keeping up the pressure. It's amazing what a dedicated minority can do. In this case, a dedicated minority that's being asked, who actually represent the viewpoint of the majority. I have a satellite dish, and I monitored absolutely every briefing that occurred all day today. Those that don't appear on the regular news show up on various satellite feeds from which pooled media take their reports. What was said in the briefing reports does not even come close to what the media, as though someone flipped a switch. Someone behind all the networks, which is really the way they get their news most of the time. Every single network started singing the same tune. It was as though someone got mad because they're not satisfied with the reports from the military and from the Pentagon telling them what they want to know, exact damage that has been dished out by this six-day air war. That's all that's been going, 6 days. And because they cannot obtain the information that satisfies them, which if they had it, they would immediately unleash negative criticism to challenge the veracity of the report, because it's coming from our side. And because they can't get that, it's as though somebody said, all right, we'll show them. If they won't tell us we're winning, we'll tell the world we're losing. And as though a switch was flipped, every network starts saying that there's great disappointment. We are not achieving the damage that we thought we could. The battle plan is not progressing as well as the military thought it should. And nothing in the briefings ever came close to that. And since they can't get the United States, it reminds me of Joshua on the side of the hill, who didn't know what was going on the mountain and didn't know what was going on in the camp, but he had his mouth going, telling Moses first it was war and then it was a party, or vice versa, and it was neither. So they're quoting a Russian saying that we're missing 90% of our targets. Now I wonder how he knows. But that becomes news, uncriticized. They were told at least 15 different ways, a 10-year-old could understand it, that 80% success in the sorties means that 80% of the planes sent out accomplished the mission of carrying the load or doing what they were supposed to do, protecting the bombers they were flying with, or providing tanker service to those that needed to be fueled in the air. Whatever the objective of the aircraft, 80% of them arrived at the target or the place of their performance and performed what they were supposed to do, which is drop the bombs according to schedule on the target as best they could and got back. With the samples we have seen of the precision ability of the equipment, we can guess positively, but not with precision, that if 80% of the planes dropped their bombs on the target specified, found it, dropped the bombs on it, got out and came home, we can guess positively that somebody got shook off their toilet. At the very least. To then try to equate 80% accomplishment of the mission as best you can, finding in cloudy weather the target with equipment that can see through clouds and in the dark, 24 hours a day, 10,000 sorties, 80% of them dropping their ordnance on the target. Anybody with an ounce of sense knows Iraq is getting a hell of a shaking up. The only eyewitness accounts we have, the latest, a peace group that came out of Baghdad today, confirms, and each and every person leaving Iraq tells the same story. In addition to what we have seen, the precision ability of the equipment, there's no water, there's no electricity, there's no power. And they still say we're having no effect, or it's disappointing, the war is disappointing as it progresses, so far. Every airplane that's gone in the air has been shot down. So some brilliant strategist has figured out he's sitting on his planes and going to counterattack us later. Okay? Then 185 get shot down instead of 17. I mean, the record is 100%. The Mirages and the MiGs have come up, and every one of them went down. How many of you remember the Israeli-Syria war? Every single Syrian plane goes down. None of the Israeli planes are lost in air-to-air combat. If he's saving them, he's saving them to flee when all is lost. I've seen films of carpet bombing. The news media has been told, as we have been told, that the bombs can have a delayed charge, can penetrate 40 feet into the ground and then explode. Oh, but they have bunkers with 45,000 troops. Fine. We'll kill the other 530,000. And I used to hunt gophers. It's great fun. You just sit and wait until they poke a head up. I'm so tired of the scare tactics of the media. If they can't get what they want, they've turned to become now not just a willing propaganda machine for what Saddam feeds them. They will demoralize. I mean, it's obvious their frustration. Once in a while, they tell the truth that they don't know what's going on. But in between those rare glimpses of inadvertent truth, they now are seeking to convince the American public that it's not going good at all. 10,000 sorties. And where did you hear anybody cheering on the media today that we didn't lose one single airplane today? Not a one. With another 2,000 sorties. And then here come the Scuds. 100,000, batting 1,000 in Saudi Arabia. The Israeli censors will not let us know what happened. But there was a comment at the end of the ABC news. NBC had the plug jerked on them, by the way. And they made an apology that was less than convincing. As Tom Brokaw said, yes, we did violate the rules. And Israel had demanded that they stay off for 2 hours and apologize. And Tom Brokaw said, we did violate the rules inadvertently. How do you inadvertently violate the rules when you've been told not to name the casualties? And they named the casualties. Brokaw said, yes, we did break the rule inadvertently. And we apologize. And he was just as unconvincing, having been coerced by the competitive ratings race, he was just as unconvincing as the pilots are in the statements that are coerced out of them with much torture. The media made a point of putting ex-prisoners of war on so that they could announce their surprise that Saddam Hussein had beat him around the face, where it was apparent. The Vietnamese were smart enough to beat him in areas that it wasn't exposed, so the bruises didn't show on the face. Now, when you're dealing with a sadist, you may assume they're smart, and they are smart in certain shrewd ways, but not necessarily as smart as the media would like to give them credit, as they have spent all day telling us how great Saddam's military machine is and how bad the war is going and how far short of what we should be able to expect. We are even including lying about the president being frustrated. But you notice the next couple of pilots that show up have obviously been beaten somewhere else, having been instructed. And seeing the reaction of the world, so their faces were not as beaten, but the tonality and the monotone and the all other aspects suggest and telegraph a tortured, cruelly obtained statement. And now we come to the Scuds in Israel. They bat 1,000 with the Patriot in Saudi Arabia. Just one sentence at the end of ABC. that a report had come in that the patriots that were fired were not fired by the new American crew, but rather were fired by the Israeli crew from the old Patriot batteries, the Israeli crew being the training crew. Nothing else said, no qualification of the source, no idea whether it's true or false. Another report comes in from a Pentagon correspondent, an unnamed, highly placed source, that the Israeli army is tactically in control of the Patriot batteries. The American soldiers that came with the battery merely operate it, which means that the order to fire and when will come from the Israeli command, not American control. Again, after that statement, no further confirmation. There's obviously some reason why they bat 1,000 in South Arabia and miss at least one in Tel Aviv. No statement allowed. We used to get a statement of how many missiles had lifted off, picked up by our spy satellites, and how many were flying toward Tel Aviv. So we don't know whether there were 6 or 8, and the Patriot missiles got them all but one. Whether there were 2, as is implied, and they got one and one got through. But what we do have proof of is we're getting nothing but misinformation peddled to us. Information, rumor, greed, seeking after being the first to report whether true or false. Only thing gives me great joy is when I see them start sweating and almost fainting when they think they're standing there a minute too long and the air raid siren goes off. One of them smelt some jet fuel the other night and almost had a heart attack getting his gas mask on. But there is a way to report the Israeli scenario. They have blown up 3 missile landings into the greatest military events of these 6 days. We fly 10,000 sorties. 80% of those that had ordnance dropped them. And if they're going to show the terror and the confusion and the tragedy which hits Tel Aviv, and the comments that they give in South Arabia, that this is going to affect the pilots and their competency because they can't sleep and can't get rest, why not use that as a springboard to say, now having seen this, can't you imagine what's happening to the Republican Guard when for 24 hours every day carpet bombing is rolling across them hour after hour after hour? When you see the way this is affecting Tel Aviv, can you imagine? And if you listen, even those cruelly programmed spokesmen around the world for the Iraqi government, the ambassador to Japan, I noticed as he talked to Koppel last night, his lips started twitching. He got so sufficiently cornered, his lips started twitching. And the one that's left in Washington sort of slipped in the way he described the effect on the Baghdad peoples, justifying what was done to the pilots, which is mixing apples and oranges. He then began to run off of the mouth about the citizens of Baghdad who are suffering an attack after hour, hour after hour, as if they've been invaded from space. I thought that was a Freudian slip. that told their state of mind. They never got anything like that from Iran. So if they're going to report what's happening in Tel Aviv, at least they had power in the hospital they took them to. At least they had power and lights in the streets. At least there was water. They could have contrasted the effects of one bomb falling at random. At random. There are only two things happen when our people drop bombs. They either hit the target or do something like the Scud does in Tel Aviv. And he thinks most of them hit the target. Otherwise, we'd had more pictures on TV of civilians being slaughtered that Saddam would peddle everywhere. So if they're going to show what happens with one of these Scuds landing in Tel Aviv, why not build off of that? Since they can't get news from the military, why not build off of that? And say we can deduce from what this one missile fired at random has done to terrorize this whole city. We can imagine what the nonstop 24-hour-a-day, 6 days, 10,000 sorties must be doing without having to see pictures of it to Iraq and to those that are in Kuwait. And last but not least, the military better find a spokesperson. And they better cashier that Marine that thought he was a preacher. I mean, the media has loved to grab on to that Marine that's telling those poor guys sitting there in the sand that he made some commitment when he was in Vietnam that he would never let boys go into war again without delivering his soul. So he proceeds to tell them, if something can go wrong, it will go wrong. And everything will go wrong. Then he starts preaching that there's only one thing that will carry him in war, and that's love. And oh, how the media grabbed that. Love, like a mother's love who runs into a building to save her child. And he tells them, when you get out there, you're not fighting for your country, you're not fighting for the Marines, you're fighting for your life and for your buddy. I can only hope that some of it, I happen to have Patton's original speech. I may bring it, read it to you one night. But he also had something to say about the purple bleeping second wave they had to go against after they finished with the Germans. But I couldn't help but hope that some of those guys sitting in that sand could remember, if they couldn't remember Patton, at least remember George C. Scott's portrayal of his great speech. I mean, if you're fighting for your life, that means you're on the defensive. Patton said to him, he didn't want to hear anything about dying for their country. You want him to go out and make the other fellow die for his country. And this guy's up there telling them they're not fighting for their country. I guess that means they're not fighting for any cause. They're fighting for their life and for their buddies. Now that means you got a imprisoned, drafted, no choice army that's put in a position as prisoners who in that position will be motivated to fight for their life and for their buddies who are also fighting for their life. It's a volunteer army. When are we going to remember that again? Anybody joined and didn't know in today's world, what were we going to do if Russia moved? And those that are doing the briefing, they must have, I mean, number one, so far they've managed to find briefers that look like fat old men, not hardened soldiers that command respect. They can't even intimidate those newsmen or guys that haven't yet revealed to the army brass their monastic life. I haven't heard a real man talk yet, except lower ranks. I haven't heard a real man wearing the uniform give a briefing yet since Cheney, Powell, and Schwarzkopf himself stopped talking. Where they're finding these understudies to go out and handle the press is beyond me. They're obviously scared of the press, scared of their shadow, scared to open their mouth, and they do not represent the fine qualities that you get when the camera finally is allowed to talk to one of our pilots, one of our Patriot battery sergeants, one of the guys in the foxhole, one of the tank commanders. They could pull any tank commander. And if there's anything going to lose this war for us, because the war depends upon the spirit of the people, is the continued use of these mealy mouths that are reporting. It's like they're scared to say, look, I ain't going to answer you. You can talk all day. I ain't answering that question. You may decide people want to know. I believe the people don't want Saddam to know. That ends that subject. Let me look the other side of the room. The other part of it is, where did they find this Pete Williams or whatever his name is? I mean, he's a typical little Eastern establishment appearing, but he's a typical little snot who's got a quick brain and immediately antagonizes by his patronizing air. And somebody somewhere has got to establish the perimeters in that news briefing, Kennedy style or Truman style, that says without equivocation. The one today came very close. He got almost mad and he got very close. He said, there's obviously a discrepancy between what we know and what we're telling you. That's the closest to truth. I almost applauded. So the Army's got to find better spokesmen. But in spite of all that, I can figure out who's winning. Can't you?
Yes, sir.
But the media would have us believe we're losing. And they're all trying to figure out why Saddam put these pilots out there. Well, he knew his own people would believe whatever. He rules his own people through fear. So this is a perfect way to demonstrate what happened to them if they oppose him. But everything he does is designed to break the will through cruelty, like savage tribes to you who know their history. It's designed to break the will of America more than any other reason for putting those pilots on TV, and the network is helping him by doing it. He wants to terrorize the American pilots because he has underestimated our will. Well, that one's going to backfire because I'm convinced, as one soldier says, it has galvanized the pilots and the soldiers into wanting to kill every one of them they can find. That hasn't made them afraid. It's made them murderous. That may explain why we didn't lose any planes today. They were really careful. Get on the phone. Well, it's nice to know we have our ears on, Dr. Scott, and we're behind you 100% from... I don't often use names, but they don't mind. Merle Haggard and Teresa. Nice to know they're watching. We've been playing his song. I'm going to play it again, too. But not right this minute. Now, I want to clarify one thing. I don't even quarrel with Stormy Norman's ability to handle the press. And his qualities have not yet been fully revealed. He speaks both French and German, an opera, a ballet buff, as well as a soldier who earned the title Stormy Norman. Furthermore, I believe the other people that are being used as spokesmen are, without a doubt, good soldiers. But there needs to be some more attention paid to the medium of TV since it's being used to affect the spirit of America. And instead of trying to give everybody a little bit of time on TV, they better pick the kind of spokesman that can communicate some confidence to the American people. Because it's obviously not being done now, and it is so easy. The most decorated living American hired by one of the weekly news magazines was on Larry King. He went over somewhat critical of the Army, but his assessment when he got there was that the Army might not even have to be used. His assessment, which is from a pretty experienced perspective and with an aggressive ability to communicate his viewpoint, is that we're, I borrow his choice of words since he knew he was on television, kicking the snot out of him. And I can assure you we are. It's impossible to be otherwise. I mean, the TV themselves have made the point to see battle-hardened Israel, who's gone through war after war. Talk about Iran being toughened. You have an Israel as tough a society as the world has ever seen. Survivors of German death camps and Russian persecution, hemmed on all sides, and to see the effect of 3 Scud missiles landing. Well, imagine the effect 24 hours a day on a population that their own ambassador in America, I think inadvertently said, think they're being attacked from outer space. Saddam Hussein has ruled by terror. He formed the security, internal security group that took over the Ba'ath Party. The ideologue of the Ba'ath Party, who recommended him for his first position of power, was a student of Hitler and Mussolini and a fascist. What you face is a racist who will use religious fanaticism to further his purpose. Who holds his nation by a rule of terror. He simply does not believe that America has the will to stand up to him. He, I'm sure, had other purposes, but certainly included as a paramount purpose in placing the soldiers so quickly on television with their faces beaten until the treatment meted out to them was obvious, was designed to scare American pilots who were flying the sorties. Now, he didn't reckon with the fact that it's producing the opposite reaction and the pilots already interviewed who viewed it this morning are as enraged as most of you are. I'm quite sure it had an effect of adding a little to their adrenaline. If there was anything that could increase beyond their professional confidence and natural attention to survival, the heightened awareness of the cruel animal into whose hands they might fall would intensify their care and using the machines that are theirs for survival as they fly into that air defense system. But all day long today, we heard how great the Iraqi air defense system is. But 2,000 planes went and came back, and not one was shot down. Well, I believe that it's a great air defense system. But how about hearing how great we are? Apparently, we've gone up against the greatest. They listened to the media, and they couldn't knock one down. Not one. Now, my explanation of the Patriots is, and Israel's, threefold. Either the Israelis did shoot their battery with trainees because of their obsession with defending themselves. Or the Israel tactical commanders were just a little too slow when given the order to get them off. Or the quickly installed Patriot batteries with the crew from Europe were just not as sharp as the ones that have been training for the last 5 months in the Arabian Desert. I mean, they've been in Eastern Europe with probably more time off and less discipline to their job than those never knowing when the battle would start the last 5 months in Arabia. I've been around men too long and know the difference between a morale level and an intensity level when you are disciplined and trained and ready versus the attitude of those that have been in the same place for years without the threat. But we aren't getting any explanations. But it's obvious that they've batted 1,000 in South Arabia, and the media is making more out of one miss than all the hits. I mean, they must put a negative tone on anything that we do. I say they're traitors. It's treasonous. Keep laying into them. Keep their phones jammed. These traitors in the media. Giving away every secret that they can. Los Angeles Call says another explanation of the Scuds getting through is a friend said that some scientist or general was telling the media that if more than one Scud goes up at a time, that the Patriot will get confused with two or more Patriots going after the same target. Within hours after that statement, the multiple Scud launches began. Now, wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to sit in your bunker in Baghdad and give the order to fire the Scuds and then turn on CNN and wait for them to be your spotters? That's what's happening. Now, And then that's what I'm used at ABC today, showing civilian satellite pictures and boring us for 20 minutes by explaining that a line was a road. And maybe the best military analyst is that one on ABC, because he wrote a very enlightening book on the Iraq-Iran war. But even he had to labor with that one, trying to explain what these civilian satellite maps that were probably weather satellites were revealing. And when he got done, because he hadn't sent anything, before Jennings tried to retreat, but say, and this was his summation of it. Well, that's why we have military advisors. The satellites that we have for the military can see a license plate. You don't have to explain distant little gray lines that look like pictures we've seen of the astronauts taking pictures out the window of their satellite as roads. They can see a license plate on a truck. And this SCUD thing, militarily unimportant unless they use poison gas, and there's a simple solution to their use of poison gas: nuke them. Even international codes will let you respond in kind if they violate the, not as the Japanese ambassador said, that you can use anything to defend when you've been attacked. You can defend in kind when they violate the code. You can respond defensively to such. In short, if they hit you below the belt, go ahead and kick them in the crotch. To simplify what's being said. We've only been in this war 6 days. Hadn't been 6 years. We're winning it.
Yes, sir.
We've had one engagement, 5 dead Iraqis and 17 or 24, whatever it is, prisoners. We have, now they're trying to scare us to death with the land war. My guess is there'll be casualties, but we'll find that there's sophisticated weaponry at that level that's going to shock the world, and there'll be new scientific heroes, and we'll find out that tanks have some Star Wars capacities to them. I mean, our tanks can move at high speed and hit a target 2 miles away while moving. The shooting tank, our tank, moving at high speed, can hone in on a target and hit it 2 miles away. Theirs can't do that. After dark. We have mobile howitzers that can fire 10 miles. They're talking about their great artillery. That's like trying to scare somebody because there's an army of people out there with 22s. And we're loaded down with 30-06s. You just find a hill a little ways beyond where the 22s plop in the sand. And you annihilate the 22 shooter. Our guns will lob them over there 10 miles. With precision. And they can't shoot that far. Well, but we're going up against 4,000 artillery pieces. Well, if you got 400 that can stay out of their range and hit them with 4,000 shells, that's a pretty good equalizer. I'm tired of being scared to death. It's war is rough, no matter how bad it is. It's pretty tough driving through, well, today, driving down 210 in Pasadena, where a driver was shot and his passenger wounded. And 210 out here east of Pasadena is jammed up. Pretty scary to go through East Los Angeles. But it's war, and we're going to win it, and I wish the media quit scaring us to death. That's not an air raid alarm. That is not. The whole sound's gone crazy. I don't know what you're doing up there, but you've destroyed the sound. We are not under attack from a Scud missile. We are not. Will some engineer come down here and hear what you're doing to us? This is the worst thing that's ever happened. I think we're being jammed by some peace yeller. What in the world have you done to us? What have you done to it, Joe? What do you mean it's my radio? Well, I didn't turn it on, so who did? Go punch it. I never turned it on. I called, witnessed everybody in this room. I leaned down there and got my cigar before the radio was even here. Did anybody see me even look that direction? I never turned the radio on. Who turned it on? Huh? Well, you hooked it up, Brad, so you must be the guilty one. What are you saying? You're an attorney. Leave it to an attorney to... if you want something really fouled up... The first letter's accurate. The rest of it's sort of misspelled. If you really want something fouled up, get an attorney to do it. I still don't like the sound, Joe. There's an echo. Now, the radio's off, so what's your explanation now? I mean, I have something important to say, but not with sound like this. So give me a song, and then I'll start saying what I was going to say before we got so rudely interrupted. Now, when you call the networks and complain, you're going to get some little twit. I probably could have used the other word with a different vowel. And there would have been some who think I had said something bad. But if you really knew your English, you would know that that word with a different vowel that I didn't use originally meant a small, unnecessary piece on the garment of a nun. Go check it out if you want to. So what you think I almost said ain't so bad, really. The important part being it was an unnecessary piece. You'll probably get that unnecessary piece on the phone telling you that the Constitution guarantees the public the right to know. No, it doesn't. You tell them. Go back to their textbook, because that ain't true. All the Constitution says Congress shall make no law restricting freedom of the press. But over the years, there is a long record of case history that becomes the law of the land from the Supreme Court. They used to say that is to be interpreted in the frame that Congress shall make no law to restrict these First Amendment freedoms, except when there is a clear and present danger to the survival of the Union. More recently, they've even modified that, but while we're on that subject, there is a case on record, still the law of the land, of newspapers who were publishing the sailing dates during the Second World War, and a law was passed to restrict them from doing that. They argued First Amendment, public's right to know, and the Supreme Court ruled there was a clear danger to the survival of the Union because all the German U-boat captains had to do was read or have radioed to them by someone who read the newspaper to know where the ships were sailing, and they'd sink them. And there was a present danger because they were doing it right then and there. Zilch on the newspaper's right to publish it, which is right on point to what's happening now. In more recent years, the government has abandoned the clear and present danger approach to Supreme Court weighing of the constitutionality of laws or actions of government that encroach upon the First Amendment, and I've decried that change. I find it very difficult to be on the side against those that are using the First Amendment to cloak their heinous deeds. And I have decried for some years the change of the Supreme Court frame of reference because upon abandonment of the clear and present danger doctrine, they adopted the test to determine the constitutionality of a law and the right to encroach upon a First Amendment absolute frame. A compelling state interest must exist and be declared by the encroaching party, the government, and there must be no lesser alternative way to achieve the compelling state interest. No other alternative of less offense to the First Amendment right is available. In the last very few years, particularly in some of the opinions that Scalia and Rehnquist have written, there is the abandonment of the no lesser alternative doctrine. Now, the only test that they are applying is a compelling state interest exists, such as the compelling interest to eradicate the harm to society of dope, automatic weapons, and other such encroachments on absolute freedoms. And all of these things are weighing different claims. The right to bear arms against the compelling state interest to limit automatic weapons. The right to be free from search and seizure and safe in your home. They've narrowed that circle. A motor home is no longer exempt. They can stop you and search you. I've been on the side of the First Amendment people all these years, but I'm starting to, in my old age, balance my middle age. If you won't protest me saying that, I will. I have started to balance where the media is involved, and I think what has gotten me disturbed is their hypocrisy. We have watched them become the spear point to destroy religious freedom in this country over the last decade because a few nuts have abused that freedom. The press has led the parade, supporting and justifying the encroachments on religious freedom, which is protected by two clauses in the First Amendment: free expression and the Establishment Clause. I've sat here many times and said, they're cognate clauses, friends. You let them take it away from you in one area, it'll get to you eventually. Now the press is starting to feel the pinch. And they're going to say to you, the public has a right to know. Well, those servicemen, under international law, this is protected. They are not to be paraded. They are not to be abused and shamed by publicly paraded. Doesn't matter what Saddam Hussein, it matters, but the press cannot be held responsible for what Saddam Hussein does. But there's just as much in the Constitution regarding the right of privacy that the families of those beaten and tortured servicemen and those servicemen themselves, that is just as much a right protected by the same Constitution as the right to publish, and there is no public's right to know guaranteed in the Constitution. If the public had a right to know everything, the Constitution that gives freedom to the press would not guarantee the privacy of your home against search and seizure. If the public had a right to know everything, there would be no privacy clauses, many times reiterated by the Supreme Court as part of the penumbra of the 14th Amendment and the due process clauses of the Constitution. If the public had a right to know everything, there would be no due process clause in the Constitution. If the public had a right to know everything, there would be no Fifth Amendment in the Constitution. Now, don't let some little twit get away with telling you that kind of garbage on the telephone when you call next time. Give them a lesson in what the Constitution has to say. We are in a time of national emergency. It is not to be compared to Korea. There was no declaration of war in Korea. We are in an event for the first time since the Second World War where there is a declaration of war by our Congress. Not only that, Congress and the world body. So the arguments between the executive and the legislative branch have been resolved, the executive branch arguing that the highest laws that bind this country in external relationships are treaties. If you have a treaty, you don't get a congressional declaration of war to act on a mutual defense treaty. That treaty has already been done. And if our agreements with the United Nations can be interpreted as treaty, it's for the Supreme Court to resolve whether or not some of those wars where no declaration was had that was based on something else, from the Gulf of Tonkin resolution to treaties, were constitutional, and it's not been resolved. But that's a moot question because in this case, Congress voted. Doesn't matter whether it's small or great. The rules determine the number of votes necessary to pass, and that's the way the system works. We are at war, and there are certain rules that kick in times of national emergency. And if the press cannot responsibly police itself and quit abusing its privileges then we're all going to lose some of the privileges because of their evil, self-serving, self-seeking, fill their pockets with gold, because that's the motive. Let's get the sham and the hypocrisy out. It don't have a damn thing to do with the public's right to know. It's who's going to get the ratings. So don't let them cram that crap down your throat. The Constitution does not guarantee the public's right to know. Ask her to quote the chapter and verse of the Constitution next time the twit makes her speech. The public has a right not to know certain things. That's what the Constitution balances. The public has a right not to have someone treated as guilty when they have a right to be treated as innocent until proven guilty. Because the public has a right to every benefit in that social contract that made us a nation. And the press has looked down their nose at those of us who have tried desperately to stem the tide, taking away all religious rights. Well, now it's my turn. My turn to say they've abused their rights. Anything I can do to see them get it, they got it coming. So go for them. Don't let the twit push you around. Get on telephone. By the way, when the media gets through and the peace yellows get through, we'll be to blame if there's any ecological harm from the Iraqis setting the oil fields on fire. I'm still in favor of a tactical nuclear strike. I think it'd make them peaceful real quick. I mean, we send missiles with cameras on their nose. Not only hit the target dead center, send the second one right behind it, go through the hole it just made. And we're not doing any damage. The media asks such stupid questions as, why can't we find the Scuds? Why should we? If they run the Patriot missiles right, they aren't doing that much damage. It's been said over and over again, they're not militarily significant. And you don't really think that we should be distracted into chasing trucks all over the desert when we can find them after they fire? Planes shouldn't be flying all over Iraq trying to find those silly trucks. They're not that important militarily. Far better to send all the planes concentrating right now on the Republican Guard. The media is crazy. Make me sick. I like having the intelligent people who watch me call them. Blytheville, Arkansas. When I called the news media about their stupidity, they told me, we're not in a war, we are in a conflict. I then said, why is your program called America at War? He hung up. Fort Devens, Massachusetts. I'm with the 10th Special Forces Division out of Fort Devens, Massachusetts, and we've been called up to be shipped out to the Middle East. Would you like your blessing as we head into battle? You got it. This will stay on our prayer list until this war is over. You know, I thought maybe it's all fiction, but everyone recognizes the expertise with Stephen Kuntz and the books that he's written and the movie that has just come out, doesn't really do justice, as usual, to the book. And fiction writers have a way. They make it because they have a way with words and enabling you to move right inside the character and live with him and do what he's doing. This book, The Flight of the Intruder, gives you a little feel of what it's like to pilot an A6. The starboard bow catapult fired, and the A6A intruder accelerated down the flight deck with a roar that engulfed the aircraft carrier and reverberated over the night sea. The plane's wings bit into the air, and the machine began to climb into the blackness. 15 seconds later, the bomber was swallowed by the low-lying clouds. In a few minutes, the climbing intruder broke free of the clouds, and the pilot, Lieutenant Jake Grafton, abandoned the instrument panel and contemplated the vaulted stars. A pale slice of moon illuminated the cloud layer. Looking below, Grafton spoke to his companion pilot in the other seat. "Look at the stars tonight, Morg." Lieutenant Junior Grade Morgan McPherson, the bombardier navigator, sat on the pilot's right, his face pressed against the black hood that shielded the radar screen from extraneous light. He straightened and glanced up at the sky. "Yeah," he said, then readjusted the scope hood and resumed the never-ending chore of optimizing the radar presentation. He examined the North Vietnamese coastline 100 miles away. Now, this is written, remember, with the technology of Vietnam. And we move light years forward with these same planes. The B-52s are outfitted with new radar and new protective devices. And as you well know, electronics and other companion science moves at a Doppler effect, compounding as it moves forward. Yet, this written in the frame of ancient North Vietnam. "Yeah," he said, then readjusted the scope hood and resumed the never-ending chore of optimizing the radar presentation. He examined the North Vietnamese coastline 100 miles away. "I got an update. I'm cycling to the coast in point." He pushed a button on the computer and the steering bug on the pilot's visual display indicator slipped a quarter inch sideways, giving the pilot steering information to the point on the coast where the intruder would cross into North Vietnam. Grafton turned the aircraft a few degrees to follow the steering command. "Did you ever stop to think maybe you're getting too wrapped up in your work," he said, "that you're in a rut?" Morgan McPherson pushed himself back from the radar hood and looked at the stars overhead. "They're still there, and we're down here. Let's check the ECM again." "The problem is you're just too romantic," Grafton told him, and reached for the electronic countermeasures panel. Together, they ran the equipment through the built-in tests that verified the ECM was working. Two pairs of eyes observed each indicator light, and two pairs of ears heard each beep. The ECM, or electronic countermeasure gear, detected enemy radar emissions and identified them for the crew. When the ECM picked up radar signals it had been programmed to recognize as threatening, it would broadcast false images to the enemy operator. Satisfied all was working properly, the airmen adjusted the volume of the ECM audio so that it could be heard in their earphones, yet would not drown out the intercom system over which they talked to each other or the radio. The two men flew on without speaking. each listening to the periodic bass tones of the communist search radars sweeping the night. Each type of radar had its own sound. The low beep was a search radar probing the sky. Higher pitch tones were the fire control radars seeking to acquire a target. And a nightmare falsetto was a locked-on missile control radar guiding its weapon. 50 miles from the North Vietnamese coast, Jake Grafton lowered the nose of the intruder 4 degrees, and the A-6 began its long descent. When he had the aircraft trimmed, Jake tugged all the slack from the harness straps, securing him to his ejection seat. Then exhaled, and like a cowboy tightening a saddle girth, pulled the straps as snugly as he could. That done, he asked for the combat checklist. Leaving nothing to chance or memory, McPherson read each item off his kneeboard card, and both men checked the appropriate switch or knob. When they reached the last detail on the checklist, Jake shut off the aircraft's exterior lights and turned the IFF to standby. The IFF, or Parrot, radiated electronic energy that enabled an American radar operator to see the aircraft as a coded blip he could readily identify as friend or foe. Grafton had no desire to appear as a blip, coded or uncoded, on a North Vietnamese radar screen. In fact, he hoped to escape detection by flying so near the ground that the radar return reflected from his plane would merge with the radar energy reflecting off the earth, the ground return. The pilot keyed his radio mic. The voice scrambler beeped. Then Jake spoke. Devil 505 is strangling, Parrot. Coast in 3 minutes. Devil was the A-6 squadron's radio call sign. Roger, 505, responded the airborne controller circling over the Gulf of Tonkin in an E-2 Hawkeye, a twin-engine turboprop with a radar dish mounted on the top of the fuselage. The Hawkeye also had launched from the carrier. The intruder was going on the hunt, camouflaged by darkness and hidden by the earth itself from the electronic eyes of the enemy. Jake Grafton would fly as low as his skill and nerves allowed, which was very low indeed. The pilot cast a quick, last look at the distant stars. Flying now to 450 knots, the bird plunged into the clouds. Jake felt the adrenaline begin to pump. He watched the pressure altimeter unwind and shot anxious glances at the radar altimeter, which derived its information from a small radar in the belly of the plane that looked straight down and measured the distance to the ground or sea. He briefly wished that he could turn it off because he knew its emissions could be detected, but he needed this device. The pressure altimeter told him his height above sea level. But tonight he would have to know just how high he was above the earth. As he passed 5,000 feet, the radar altimeter began to function and matched the readings of the pressure altimeter perfectly, just as it should over the sea. The pilot breathed deeply and forced himself to relax. Dropping below 2,000 feet, he eased the stick back and slowed the rate of descent. With his left hand, he advanced the throttles to a high cruise power setting. The airspeed stabilized at 420 knots, Grafton's preferred speed for treetop flying. The A-6 handled very well at this speed, even with the drag and weight of a load of bombs. The machine would fly over enemy gunners too fast for them to track it, even if they should be so lucky as to make out the dark spot fleeting across the night sky. Jake Grafton's pulse pounded as he brought the plane down to 400 feet above the water. They were below the clouds now, flying in absolute darkness, not a glimmer of light visible, and the emptiness between sea and sky. Only the dimmed lights of the gauges, which were red so as not to impair the night vision of the crew, confirmed that there was a world beyond the cockpit. Jake peered into that blackness, trying to find the telltale ribbon of white sand that marked the Vietnamese coast on even the darkest nights. Not yet, he told himself. He could feel the rivulets of sweat trickle down his face and neck, some running into his eyes. He shook his head violently, not daring to take his stinging eyes from the red gauges on the black panel in front of him for more than a second. The sea was just below, invisible, waiting to swallow the pilot who failed for a few seconds to notice a sink rate. There, to the left, the beach. The pale sand caught his eye. Relax. Relax and concentrate. The whiteness flashed beneath them. Coast in, Jake told the bombardier. McPherson used his left hand to activate the stop clock on the instrument panel and keyed his radio mic with his left foot. Devil 505 is feet dry. Devil 505, feet dry. A friendly American voice answered, 505 Black Eagle, roger, feet dry, good hunting. Then silence. Later, when Devil 505 returned to the coast, they would broadcast their feet wet call. Grafton and McPherson knew that now they were on their own, because the Hawkeye's radar could not separate the A6's image from the Earth's return without the aid of the IFF. Jake saw the moonlight reflecting faintly off rice paddies, indicating a break in the overcast ahead. The weather forecasters were right for a change, he thought. Out of the corner of his eye, the pilot saw flashes. Intermittent flashes in the darkness below. Small arms fire, Morg. Okay, Jakey, baby. The bombardier never looked up from his radar scope. His left hand slewed the computer crosshairs across the scope while his right hand tuned the radar. This computer is working great, but it's a little... And he stopped, muttering over the ICS. Jake tried to ignore the muzzle flashes. Every kid and rice farmer in North Vietnam had a rifle and apparently spent the night shooting randomly into the sky at the first rumble of jet engines. They never saw their targets, but hoped somewhere in the sky a bullet and an American warplane would meet. Big morale booster, Jake thought, lets every citizen feel he's personally fighting back. Jake saw the stuttering muzzle flashes of a submachine gun. None of these small arms fired tracer bullets, so the little droplets of death were everywhere and nowhere. Patches of moonlight revealed breaks in the clouds ahead. The pilot descended to 300 feet and used the moonlight to keep from flying into the ground. He was much more comfortable flying visually rather than on instruments. With an outside reference, he could fly instinctively. On instruments, he had to work at it. Off to the right, anti-aircraft artillery opened fire. The tracers burned through the blackness in slow motion. The warble of a fire can gun control radar sounded for a second in his ears, then fell silent. A row of artillery fire erupted ahead of them. Christ, Morg, he whispered to the bombardier. He picked a tear in the curtain of the tracers, dipped a wing, and angled the jet through them. McPherson didn't look up from the scope. You got the river bend yet? Jake asked as the flak storm faded behind them. Yep, just got it. 3 more minutes on this heading. McPherson reached with his left hand and turned on the master armament switch. He checked the position of every switch on the armament panel one more time. The dozen 500-pound bombs were now ready to be released. Your pickle is hot, he told the pilot, referring to the red button on the stick grip which the pilot could press to release the weapons. Again and again, fiery streams of anti-aircraft shells spewed forth like projectiles from a volcano. The stuff that came in the general direction of Devil 505 seemed to change course and turn behind them. An optical illusion created by the plane's 700 feet per second speed. The pilot ignored the guns fired behind or abreast and concentrated on negotiating his way through the strings of tracers that erupted ahead. He no longer even noticed the flashes from rifles and machine guns, the sparks of this inferno. A voice on the radio. Devil 508 is feet dry, feet dry. There's Cowboy, Jake thought. Cowboy was Lieutenant Commander Earl Parker, the pilot of the other A-6 bomber launched moments after them. Like Jake and McPherson, Cowboy and his bombardier were now racing across the earth with a load of bombs destined for a target deeper and deeper into North Vietnam. 2 miles to the turn point, the bombardier reminded him. An insane warble racked their ears. A red light labeled missile flashed on the instrument panel 2 feet from the pilot's face. This time McPherson did look up. The two men scanned the sky. Their best chance to avoid the surface-to-air missile was to acquire it visually, then outmaneuver it. There's the SAM, 2 o'clock. Jake fought back the urge to urinate. Both men watched the white rocket exhaust while Grafton squeezed the chaff release button on the right throttle with his forefinger. Each push released a small plastic container into the slipstream where it dispersed a cloud of metallic fibers, the chaff, that would echo radar energy and form a false target on the enemy operator's radar screen. The pilot carefully nudged the stick forward and dropped to 200 feet above the ground. He jabbed the chaff button 4 more times in quick succession. The missile light stopped flashing, and the earphones fell silent as death itself. I think it stopped guiding, McPherson said, with relief evident in his voice. Boy, we're having fun now, he added dryly. Grafton said nothing. They were almost scraping the paddies. The bombardier watched the missile streak by several thousand feet overhead at 3 times the speed of sound. Then he turned his attention to the radar. Come hard left, he told the pilot. Jake dropped the left wing and eased back slightly on the stick. He let the plane climb to 300 feet. The moonlight bounced off the river below. See the target yet? Just a second, man. Silent, steady up. Jake leveled the wings. I got the target. I'm on it, stepping into attack. The bombardier flipped a switch, and the computer calculated an attack solution. The word attack lit up in red on the lower edge of the VDI, and the computer-driven display became more complex. Symbols appeared showing the time remaining until weapons release, the relative position of the target, the drift angle, and the steering to the release point. Jake jammed the throttles forward to the stops and climbed to 500 feet. The Mark 82 general-purpose bombs had to fall at least 500 feet for the fuses to arm properly. They were equipped with metal vanes that would open when the weapons were released and retard them just long enough to allow the plane to escape the bomb fragments. The needle on the airspeed indicator quivered at 480 knots. The stick was alive in the pilot's hand. Any small twitch made the machine leap. Jake's attention was divided among the mechanics of instrument flying, the computer-driven steering symbol on the VDI, and the occasional streams of yellow and red tracers. He felt extraordinarily alive, in absolute control, the adrenaline pumping. He could see everything at once, every needle, every gauge, every fireball in the night. With his peripheral vision, he even saw McPherson turn on the track radar. Ground lock. The bombardier noted the indication on the track radar and reported it to the pilot with an affectation of amazement. The damn track radar often failed. McPherson was glued to the radar screen, his entire world the flickering green light. Hot damn, we're going to get him. He feels it too, Jake thought. With the track radar locked on the target, the computer was getting the most accurate information possible on azimuth and elevation angle. On this October night in 1972... Devil 505 closed on the target, a suspected truck park. Jargon for a pencil triangle on a map where the North Vietnamese might have some trucks parked under the trees away from the prying eyes of aerial photography. The bomb run was all that existed now for Jake Grafton. His life seemed compressed into this moment without a past or future. Everything depended on how well he flew Devil 505 to that precise point in space where the computer would release the bombs to fall upon the target. The release marker on the VDI marched relentlessly toward the bottom of the display as the plane raced in at 490 knots. At the instant the marker disappeared, the 500-pound bombs were jettisoned from the bomb racks. Both men felt a series of jolts, a physical reminder that they had pulled a trigger. The attack light was extinguished when the last weapon was released, and only then did Grafton Bank left and glance outside. Tracers and muzzle flashes etched the night. "Look back," he told the bombardier as he flew the aircraft through the turn. Morgan McPherson looked over the pilot's left shoulder in the direction of the target obscured by darkness. He saw the explosions of the bombs, white death flashes, 12 and two-thirds of a second. Jake saw the detonations in his rearview mirror, rolled out of the turn on an easterly heading. Without the drag of the 500-pounders, the two engines pushed the fleeing warplane even faster through the night. Now 500 knots, almost 600 miles an hour. "Arm up the rock eyes, Morg. And we'll have some of these in the bookstore Sunday if you want to read The Flight of Intruder. But that gives you a little feel, I think, of what it's like to sit in that cockpit, much better armed, much advanced, beyond 1952. We got the equipment, but we got the skilled flyers, too, and they've been proving it. Not one plane lost today. So I think it's about time we give these guys credit for what they're doing. Just think about it for a minute. All the news people have to do is sit there and put gas masks on and off and complain that they can't pry the secrets and tell them to the enemy. Well, these guys, 2,000 a day, are going through this. Get our values straight. Get on the phone. You know, I was listening to firsthand reports from some of those that came out of Baghdad and were being interviewed at the Jordanian border after they crossed into Jordan. One woman was describing being on, I guess, on top of the hotel that all the newsmen were reporting from, seeing a cruise missile coming right at the hotel. And she said it was as though it was reading a street map. It was coming right at the hotel, then it veered right around the hotel, back in behind it, honed in on the target, and hit it. Now, that deserved the same amount of news that this random Scud missile that was able to hit a city 34 by 30 miles square. And yet we're not succeeding in our program. Give us a break. Well, Than Demas called and says, "Doc, I'm listening to the doomsayers. I just heard it on Channel 13 claiming that if we don't surrender immediately, Iraq's going to blow up all the oil fields and cause an economical disaster." Now what are they going to do? Surrender for oil? I mean, now we don't go to war to save oil, now we should surrender to save oil. I mean, I heard 5 minutes apart on two separate networks today that the cruise missiles cost $1 million. I mean, the Patriot missiles cost $1 million apiece, and then another expert said they cost $700,000. That's a 30% error factor. As if that isn't a figure you can determine. And then I heard the experts on the economic cost of the war. One network was saying It's costing $1 billion a day, and if it goes 30 days, it'll cost $28 billion. In 6 months, it'll cost $68 billion. Of course, they're figuring only February is the only month we fight, I guess. I flipped the switch with a little electric button to catch in mid-sentence an accompanying national network, one of the competitors, saying that the war is costing $500,000 a day to $750,000 a day. And they're complaining about false information. I mean, one network is saying $1 million a day, and the next network right alongside is saying $500,000 to $750,000. Those figures aren't even close. And we're talking about billions. I mean, you can make an error of $500 million and not consider it significant. Thank God we don't have the media keeping math for us. I repeat what I said earlier. It cannot be an accident. It has all the stench of a conspiracy. It's as though those who feed the news background and share it with all news directors on the various networks have made a decision that if they cannot break down the military and force the military to tell them day by day every single target that was hit, reveal all the secrets so they can tell them to the world, including the enemy, they have made a deliberate conspiratorial decision. It is suggested that's been done because of the way they all started doing it at the same time. To so attack and demean and put down what we have accomplished as a tactic to infuriate the army to come out defensively and tell them what they want to hear. As though, spoiled brats, if you won't tell us what we are doing in great detail, we're going to tell the world that we're losing. Now they're bellowing that the Patriots are not as good as we thought they were because of one miss, when we don't even know if it was our guys firing the missile. Don't even know for sure if they were permanently in place. There's got to be some fire for the smoke story that it was fired not by one of the American batteries but by one of the Israeli batteries that was already there with Israel's in training. That suggests we don't know which missile battery fired, how many missiles were fired coming in or out of the Patriot batteries. But out of that vacuum of ignorance, one Scud missile getting through now proves to our brainy, brilliant media analysts that the Patriot missiles are not as good as we thought they were. Well, by their criteria of judgment, one bleep is proof you shouldn't trust something. Then the media has condemned itself by its own words. If you're not to trust something who bleeps once, then we better never trust the media on anything they say, considering the bleeps they do. I could put another word in there, too, that I've bleeped out, several of them. Go on the telephone. Winsboro, Texas, a couple hours ago, this was yesterday's message came in, CNN ran a segment on the bad effects those prisoner of war films have on former prisoner of war soldiers. And while they were interviewing these experts who agreed that the effect was bad, they ran the films again. And on the oil wells, Red Adair is the most famous fighter of
oil well fires. He was played by John Wayne in a movie that was made about his life. He commented that setting an oil well on fire is not an easy task. It requires quite a bit of technical expertise. You just can't put a bomb and start the fire. He says, no way Iraq has the people with the technology to do it. I figure that probably his judgment on it runs risk of being a little better than the twits that read their idiot cards every night. The public has a right to know. Tell them you've been interested for a long time on their sex and snort life. Next time you talk to one of those twits in the news and they tell you the public has a right to know, say, oh, I'm glad to know that. I want to know how much money you make, and I want to know all about your sex and snort life. Public has a right to know. And then when you get the gasp, you give them a constitutional speech that the public doesn't have a right to know everything. Just thought I'd say that. Remember, I sat here and read one night some insider stories from a famous newsman who watches me and had the courage, because he knew he could trust my confidentiality, to send me some inside stories on the news people. And I read some of them and the way they look out for their own. How many of you were here when I did that? Public has a right to know has its limits. They just happen to have the microphone. Well, you've got the telephone, so use it.